Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. I'm Will Bain. Great to have your company, as always, on the programme. For years, the luxury conglomerate LVMH, owner of brands like Louis Vuitton, Moët Champagne, Christian Dior, some of your favourites, I'm sure, seemed impervious to the slowdown in luxury goods sales. Well, that seemed to change. We'll dig into why and what it tells us about what's going on in the global economy. Also on the programme today, Australia decides to take on dynamic pricing.
There's a sense that attending a popular music concert should be reasonably accessible. There might be premium options there, but the concert shouldn't be out of reach for most people.
Yes, more on how the band Green Day sparked moves from Australia to get to grips with one of global business's buzz ideas and certainly most controversial practices before we leave you on this edition of World Business Report. Perhaps you've been dynamically priced recently. I was, as I tried to queue for tickets for the Oasis gigs here in the UK. You can get in touch with us about that story or anything else you hear throughout the programme on our WhatsApp number. It's plus 44 for the UK, 330-678-3033. We're going to kick off here in Europe, though, and the first people to be intercepted at sea by the Italian Navy under a controversial migration deal with Albania are on their way to the Balkan nation to have their asylum claims processed. You might remember back in the summer, we discussed the Italian government's decision to set up camps in Albania for adult male asylum seekers to have their claims for asylum in Italy assessed by officials there in Albania. If rejected, they are sent back to countries deemed safe by the Italian government. Sara Reggio is from the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, at the port of Shenzhen in northern Albania.
Our role is a role of monitoring the rights of refugees and asylum seekers. So we are here to actually monitor the implementation, and we will see how things develop. And that's the agreement we have with the authorities, an independent monitoring role carried out with our own forces and funds.
The arrival of migrants wasn't necessarily universally welcomed in Albania. Arilda Lishi is one of those protesting her opposition to the deal.
Today we're here to challenge the dominant narrative that what's happening here is an example for Europe and a model on how to deal with illegal migration. We think it's the opposite, actually. That's why we wrote in our banner, the European dream ends here. It ends here in two ways. First, in that these immigrants who are coming, who have done these long, dangerous journeys to make it to Europe, are now being rerouted to Albania so that they will go back to their home countries. But it's also ending for us as the European concept is ending for us who see Europe as this place of democracy, of values, of human rights. And what we're seeing here is that they're being brought into these prisons and being held against European law and their human rights.
Well, our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaney told us more about this first operational use.
So the first arrivals have come into Albania at these new asylum reception centres on an Italian Navy ship. Just 16 people who want to claim asylum in Italy, but they were picked up in the Mediterranean Sea by this naval vessel, and instead of going into port in Italy, they've come directly to the port of Shenzhen in Albania, and these 16 people are the first arrivals under a very controversial arrangement between Albania and Italy, which is more or less seeing Italy offshoring its asylum procedures.
Yeah, remind us of the background of that.
So there are two facilities which have been built. One is at the port of Shenzhen itself. The other one is down the road somewhat in a town called Gjadar. And the first facility is just basically a registration facility. The second one is more of an accommodation facility. And the idea is you'll come off the boat, you'll have your case registered in the initial facility, then you'll move on to this accommodation facility while your claim is being assessed. And the Italians and the Albanians have, well, it's the Italians who are running the show, it's their officials who are running the centres, and they have guaranteed to Albania that the process will be resolved within 4 weeks. So people will know within 4 weeks whether their asylum claims have been granted by Italy. If those claims are granted, people will be transported to Italy. If they're not granted, they'll be repatriated from a military airport in Albania. And Italy is emphasising that only people who come from countries which are assessed as safe countries by Italy will be going through these procedures. There are just over 20 of these particular countries, and the 16 people who arrived today were from Bangladesh and Egypt. They're both considered safe countries by Italy. But of course, there's a lot of controversy over it, and rights activists saying that it's not really due process. People wouldn't have the right to appeal or the ability to appeal in the way they would if these were normal procedures which were being adopted.
And fairly obvious what Italy gets out of it, right? What does Albania get out of it?
Albania is saying that this is a debt of gratitude which it owes to Italy. So this is Prime Minister Edi Rama talking about why he's granted this permission for Italy to set up asylum processing centres on Albanian soil. And there's been a very long relationship between Albania and Italy. Italy has helped Albania at various crucial points in Albania's existence. But these days, Italy is home to a large number of Albanian people who go there for work and to send back remittances to people in their home country. And it's because of this strong relationship between the two countries that Edi Rama says that he has allowed Italy to go ahead. He won't be doing this for any other country.
So there's no money involved?
There's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of money involved in particular for Italy. I mean, the conservative estimates for what this is costing Italy is more than 600 million euros. And, of course, there are critics in Italy who are saying, well, hang on, this is all pretty performative. We're looking at 16 people arriving on this boat, the Navy boat Libra, and a maximum of 3,000 people at any given time being accommodated in these asylum processing centres in Albania. Couldn't that money have been better used elsewhere?
And how much of this, Guy, too, something you've covered a lot, is the backdrop to all of this, that Albania is in talks with the European Union about wanting to become a member of the bloc too?
Esprit de corps is the phrase which springs to mind, isn't it? And of course, Albania has literally just opened the first chapters in its membership negotiations with the European Union. That happened on Tuesday, and on Wednesday here we are with the first arrivals from Italy of people seeking asylum who'll have their claims processed in Albania. The timing is very convenient. It keeps Albania in the news. It presents a certain view of Albania to the rest of Europe in that it wants to be part of a solution to irregular migration, not part of the problem, because, of course, there's been a lot of publicity about irregular migration by Albanian people, particularly in small boats across the Channel to the United Kingdom. There's been plenty of that in the British media. So this is part of Albania presenting itself, being part of the solution, being part of the larger European family. And, of course, it's an element here of soft power, at the very least, in terms of what it's hoping will happen going forward with its European Union accession bid.
That's the BBC's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, there. Now, we've spoken a few times on the programme about the slowdown in sales of luxury goods firms have been reporting, and the corresponding slump in their share prices as well. One firm, though, through it all, had seemed to be somewhat impervious to that pressure. It was the French behemoth, LVMH, owner of Louis Vuitton, Moët Champagne, Christian Dior, Bulgari Jewellery, all of our producer today, Neil's favourites, and run by Europe's richest man, Bernard Arnault, as well. All of that good news, though, and that seeming resistance to the pressure changed today. Shares fell sharply as LVMH warned uncertain economic and geopolitical environment would impact its business. Yelena Sokolova is a senior equity analyst at Morningstar, follows luxury goods firms closely. Yelena, afternoon. Thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we've also got Dan Coatsworth with us. Dan's from the UK investment platform AJ Bell, who's our guest looking through what's moving financial markets for us today on the programme. Dan, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
Yelena, first of all, I say LVMH had been the one, hadn't it? The one that seemed to be I guess, the most resistant to the pressures that a lot of the big other luxury firms had been reporting. What changed today?
Yeah, so I think it really, the current results show that they are not completely immune of the slowdown that others are experiencing. And particularly in the third quarter, we saw a marked deceleration for its fashion and leather business, right? That is home to Louis Vuitton and Dior brands, top profitable division as well. And here, the main culprits for slowdown was Chinese consumers spending less, both in mainland China as well as abroad, like Japan, for instance.
Yeah. Dan, what was it that got investors so nervous? Because the share price moved as much as 7% at one point.
Well, I think it's because, like you said, it was seen as the one that seems to sort of survive the sort of the wobbles that we've seen in other companies. But you know, the fact, like you say, Chinese spending is weak. There's also no growth in the US. So US is the world's biggest luxury market. So if you're not managing to grow sales there, it's no wonder that investors are getting a little bit troubled, and they're wondering, you know, is LVMH making the same mistakes as someone like Burberry, who just went too aggressive on pricing, and people just sort of pulled back and said, oh, you know, we reached a point where we just can't afford it. We've also seen that wealthy people are not immune to cost of living crisis, that even, you know, we've seen high level of inflation, high level of interest rates, that it does affect literally everyone. So I think people are just thinking twice about their spending patterns.
Hold that thought on North America and Europe. Want to come back to that. But Yelena, just expand your point on China as well. What is it in particular then? Is it the sort of middle class that we've talked about that have been very impacted, you know, by things like the housing crisis there? Is it those kind of cities and those kind of places where we're seeing a slowdown in buying luxury? And it's goods we're talking about here, isn't it? Rather than the kind of alcohol side of the business, or both?
It's kind of both, but the thing with China is that it's important to bear in mind that Chinese consumers, they still do have this, you know, savings accumulated during pandemic years. It's just that the sentiment has not really improved for them. And I do attribute that to weakness in real estate, which is ongoing, and that historically has also impacted the sentiment of luxury consumers in China specifically. Mm-hmm. We have seen that play out in 2015, 2016, for instance, when the market slowed down substantially. So asset market prices impact the sentiment of the consumers. And as LVMH mentioned, it remains kind of at the low levels of the height of the pandemic at the moment. So they are really not feeling confident enough and comfortable enough to spend. I think aspirational consumers are more hurt across the board, also in China, as well as, of course, in the West, too. In China specifically, the companies like Hermès still mention quite good resilient demand for their leather goods, but like not so much for entry-level products like, for instance, perfumes and silks. So we do see some polarization here as well.
And what's the outlook then, Yelena? I'm guessing a sort of trimming of interest rates in most parts of the world might be better news for some of these firms, full stop.
It is. It historically has been, of course, the demand in the West, in Europe and America, has come off really strong highs post-pandemic, when people just splurged their excess savings on luxury, and now that has been coming under pressure. But it should stabilize at some point, and also the potential stabilization of the asset prices in China would be another catalyst for improvement. Typically, luxury is a cyclical business. So historically, it has been going through down cycles, and down cycles typically didn't last more than 2 years. So now we're in the first year of down cycle. Typically,
No, sorry. Really interesting, isn't it? And a fascinating one to keep watching. Sure, we'll get Yelena back on the programme to work us through that as well. Yelena Sokolova there, senior equity analyst at Morningstar. And all of this, of course, against the backdrop of that succession planning for who takes over of Bernard Arnault's many children who run various divisions within LVMH when Bernard Arnault steps down as the boss there. A story, as I say, I'm sure we're going to keep coming back to here on the programme. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. The band Green Day have become the latest to be enveloped in an increasingly common row around dynamic pricing. And the Australian government now says it's going to step in. Australia set to scrap so-called dynamic pricing amid that rising anger from fans faced with soaring prices as they try to buy in-demand tickets to see their favourite bands. Dr. Ben Green is a postdoctoral fellow at Griffith University in Brisbane, where he's studying crisis and reinvention in Australia's live music sector. And he told us why Canberra's making the move now.
The Australian government is proposing to regulate and put limits on dynamic pricing of concert tickets, among other provisions to put some guardrails around those transactions. And this response from the government is a response to quite a passionate public outcry that we've seen in recent times following the news of events like the Oasis ticket launch in the UK and other concerts being launched in Australia with this dynamic pricing model. The public response that we've seen, this passionate outcry, seems to be based on certain expectations that people have. The first one is that any transaction should have a minimum level of fairness or at least transparency, especially when you're dealing with a major company with a household name like Ticketmaster. Secondly, and more specifically here, there's a sense that attending a popular music concert should be reasonably accessible. There might be premium options there, but the concert shouldn't be out of reach for most people. And this speaks to the role of live music. It's one of the most popular ways that people participate in the arts. In Australia, half the adult population attends live music each year. And this has benefits, we know, for people and for society as a whole. So there's a sense of wanting to keep those benefits accessible.
Two really interesting areas to get into. The first one then, the fairness thing. Is that the issue here? And is that the issue that we've seen? We heard it, as you say, with the Oasis case in the United Kingdom, now with Green Day in Australia, that it's about the price changing.
I think that's the case. We've seen dynamic pricing in air travel, in hotel prices. We're used to it in tourism because that's a seasonal business. Demand changes and the price changes both to manage that demand and to reflect the demand. We can distinguish a concert, especially a major concert, that's a big deal, something like Oasis, from buying a flight or a hotel in a few different ways. And one of them is the timing that you're looking at. With these concert prices, it's working more like surge pricing, more like you'd see for trying to get an Uber at a busy time. And so what we're seeing is that people are joining the virtual queue, seeing a particular advertised price, but by the time they get to the front of that virtual queue, they're presented with a new price, which might be much more than they bargained for, and they're presented with a timer that's ticking down. So there's pressure there. And people might want to call their friends and say, right, are we doing this or not? And the other thing that's different about a concert from, say, booking a trip somewhere is that there isn't more than one choice or more than one opportunity. Often, if you're talking about one of these major concert tours, it's a take it or leave it, can't miss event. It's the sort of thing that, as we know, even through the cost of living crisis that we're having, people are saving up and splashing out on some of these major concerts. There's been a number of stadium tours lately, and where your smaller live music events are actually suffering somewhat lately, we're finding that these big name events, be it Taylor Swift or Oasis or Pink or Ed Sheeran, they're actually performing really strongly. And one explanation that's out there is that people see these as can't miss, essential events, something that they want to be a part of their year and that they'll save for, and they'll make it happen. That shows how important these things are to people. And so if you want to get access to one of these events and you are surprised all of a sudden with a price that was more than was originally advertised and a short time in which to make the transaction and enter your details, that's a stressful scenario. And you can see how people react quite passionately to that.
Having slight PTSD, my own recent experience with Oasis's tour, as you mentioned, Ben. Policing this, then, how does a government or a regulator go about policing this?
We do have laws in various countries for fair trading and consumer protection laws. And there already are basic laws, and dynamic pricing is being investigated by the UK and in Europe as to how it lines up with those consumer protection laws. Is this a case of false advertising, for example? But what the Australian government is proposing to do here is make specific regulations around online transactions, including things like subscription services, and also for things like this dynamic pricing, for people being surprised with a changing price as they're trying to purchase something, which has been a big issue with concert tickets lately. So it's really adding some specific regulation to the existing suite of law that we already have around consumer protections.
Our thanks to Dr. Ben Green of Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia there. Dan Coatsworth still with us. From the UK investment platform AJ Bell. You've been dynamically priced recently, Dan.
I think my music taste is not mainstream enough to have experienced
no surge that. Pricing on the bands you're going to see.
Yeah, no. It's fortunate, really, isn't it? So obviously these bands are looking for ways to make money, fewer people buying CDs and sort of downloads. But I think that they're really testing their fans' patience by...
Yeah, because that's the argument a lot of people make, isn't it? That it's the oldest economic story in the book, right? That it's a supply and demand. But there is something slightly different going on here, isn't there? It's sort of manipulated demand, isn't it? And manipulated supply to a point as well.
Yeah, I think it's got... We're already seeing, anecdotally, I'm hearing that real big music fans have been going concerts year in, year out. They're basically this year, they're going, I'm sorry, reached the point where I can't afford it. I've waited for that counter to come down and now presenting with this extra price. And, if we have another year of that, well, it's just going to backfire. If bands think that, or individual artists think they're going to make lots more money, then suddenly people are not prepared to pay that. I mean, there's a band called Pearl Jam in the UK, was going to play a concert in London, and it sold terribly. It was actually, they were trying to get rid of tickets at really cheap prices at the last minute. And then in the end, it got cancelled due to illness. But you can see it's the direction of travel.
And that's how it works properly, isn't it? One of our texters, and do let us know where in the world you're texting in from, because it's always interesting just to get where your perspective's coming from. But someone's texted into the programme, Dan, saying some airlines have very live demand responsive pricing. Would you ban those as well? I think sort of saying on the good side, you can get a good deal sometimes. Happy hours in pubs and bars would be another one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think maybe it's just what's the cap on the percentage extra that they can charge. But if you're suddenly presented with double the cost of a concert ticket, you perhaps push back. If you're presented with double the cost of a flight, you almost certainly wouldn't pay.
Exactly. Yeah, such an interesting area, isn't it? As I say, still time to get your thoughts in. +44 330 678 3033 on the WhatsApp, should you wish to. Dan, elsewhere, shares in ASML. This is one of the big chip makers, been at the centre of global pressures itself. It shares down, well, I'm looking at the 5-day here, down almost 17%. What's been going on?
So this company makes the machines that are critical to producing semiconductors. It's like the one end of the chain for the big semiconductor industry. Now, this industry has been doing brilliantly due to demand for all things to do with AI. You need lots of chips to process extra power. It came out and said it's had weak third quarter earnings. It downgraded guidance for next year. Interesting, it said the problem's not in the AI side, it's actually elsewhere. So that you can assume it's meaning sort of the other places, the other industries that use semiconductors might be consumer electronics or the automotive sector. And so I think the market's really panicked because everyone thought everything to do with semiconductors was meant to be racing ahead due to the AI factor. So markets were taken aback. almost everything connected with semiconductors fell last night. If you look at the stock market today, you're seeing further declines in some of those stocks as well. So people worried, you know, what is it? ASML's customers, big customers are Intel and Samsung. Both of them have been having a few problems. Is it simply sort of a knock-on effect of that? Or is it actually also linked to clampdown by the Dutch and US governments on selling?
Part of this global kind of chip wars that we've seen, isn't it? And the share's off 4.5% right now, as I look to my right as well. Dan Coatsworth of the UK investment platform AJ Bell, thanks so much for your time on the programme today. Let's round out the programme heading to Egypt, and the world's largest collection of ancient Egyptian artefacts has opened its doors to some of its galleries in Giza, close to the pyramids in central Egypt today. More than 20 years in the making, the sprawling 120-acre Grand Egyptian Museum will showcase more than 100,000 objects, including treasures from the tomb of King Tutankhamun. It's absolutely amazing if you go on the BBC website and have a look at it. Obviously, the museum not officially opening until a little bit later on in the year, but it could be a big boon for local business, perhaps. Rania Ralph is one of those hoping so. She's a tour guide in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, and has joined us on the line from there now. Rania, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Thank you a lot. It's a pleasure.
Have you had a little sneak peek at this yet, this museum?
No, I am going to visit it this Saturday.
How much interest has there been in it?
So everyone was waiting for this big event, of course, and today with the inauguration of more galleries with an exposition of 24,000 pieces, it will be amazing. And I have a lot of clients who were always asking me, when will be open the great museum? So it has been years and years we are waiting for this great event. And until now, it isn't opened officially. And I think we are preparing to something more amazing, more pharaonic than the inauguration of the Civilization Museum, which was on 2021. So I think all the eyes of all the world will be heading to Egypt for this special event very, very, very soon.
Always been plenty of history in Cairo already. Why do you think this is sort of so much of a game changer for you and the tourism industry?
Because it's very big, it's considered the biggest museum in the whole world, and also it's just in front of the Giza pyramids, which is a very important visit or attraction in the whole world. When you speak about Egypt, always you have to mention the Pyramid of Cheops, which is considered one of the seven wonders of the world. So heading there, you will for sure see the great museum. And talking now about this museum, it will attract more and more people, tourists from all over the world, to know that also Egypt is safe.
And Victoria, so our producer, who worked on this item with you today, very excited to come and visit. If Victoria and I come over, what would be the first thing you take us to in the museum?
What is the first thing to take them to the museum?
What would be the big thing you'd want to show us?
The statue of Ramses II. He's one of our greatest kings, of course.
I can see Victoria is booking her tickets already. Good luck with it. Thanks so much for speaking to us on the programme. Rania Ralph there, tour guide in Cairo, Egypt, speaking to us about the soft opening of the Grand Egyptian Museum. An amazing episode of the documentary podcast on the World Service on that from a couple of years ago. If you search for it somewhere, you will find that podcast. Well worth a listen. Thanks so much for listening today, though, to World Business Report.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news. With insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.